Chapter 9, The Yoga of the Kingly Science and Kingly Secret. The Holy Lord says, to you who argue not, shall I declare this most secret knowledge, which when joined with realization shall free you from impurity. Royal knowledge, royal secret, this the supreme purifier, readily learned by the righteous, easy to practice, eternal. Those without faith in this Dharma return without attaining me to the path of birth in this world, the realm of death, O Arjuna. All this world is pervaded by me in my unmanifest form. All beings do dwell within me, but I do not dwell within them. Nor do beings dwell within me. Behold this my divine yoga, bringing forth and supporting them. Myself yet does not dwell in them. As mighty winds move everywhere, yet always dwell in the ether. Know, Arjuna, that even so do all beings dwell within me. At the end of a kalpa, all beings merge in my prakriti. At dawn of another kalpa, I myself send them forth again. Animating my prakriti, I project again and again this whole multitude of beings helpless under prakriti's sway. And yet these acts do not bind me, sitting as one indifferent and fully unattached to them. This is the truth, Dhananjaya. Because of my proximity, prakriti produces all this. The moving and the unmoving, the world revolves because of this. Unaware of my higher state, as the great Lord of all beings, the deluded disregard me, dwelling within a human form. Of vain hopes, vain deeds, vain knowledge, without sense truly they abide in the delusive nature of the Rakshasas and Asuras. But those great souls that abide in their divine nature, Arjuna, worship me single-mindedly as their eternal origin. Glorifying me always and striving ever with firm resolve, bowing to me in devotion, always steadfast they worship me. And others sacrificing by the sacrifice of pure knowledge, worship me the all-formed as one, as distinct and as manifold. I am the rite, the sacrifice, the offering, the offered things. I am the mantra and the ghee, the fire and act of oblation. Father and mother of this world, sustainer, grandfather, the known, purifier, the pranava, the rig sama yajurvedas. Goal, supporter, the Lord, witness, abode, refuge, friend, origin, dissolution and substratum, storehouse, seed imperishable. As the sun I give heat, and I withhold and send forth rain, I am both immortality and death, being and non-being am I. The knowers of the three Vedas worship me by sacrifice, by drinking soma, and thus, made pure from sin, pray for passage to heaven, gain worlds and enjoy pleasures of the devas. Having enjoyed the heaven world with merit exhausted, they re-enter the mortal world, thus keeping the injunctions of the Vedas. Filled with desires, they constantly come and go. Those who direct their thoughts to me, worshipping me with steadfast mind, for them I secure what they lack and preserve that which they possess. Even those who with faith worship other gods also worship me, though with a mistaken approach. This is the truth, son of Kunti. Truly I am the enjoyer and lord of all sacrifices, but because they do not know me, they return subject to rebirth. To the gods go their devotees, to fathers go their devotees, to spirits go their devotees, and to me go my devotees. whoever with devotion offers a leaf, flower, fruit, or water, that I accept the devout gift offered by the pure-minded one. Whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you sacrifice or give, whatever austerity you do, do that as offering to me. Thus shall you be freed from the bonds of actions both good and evil, steadfast in renunciation, and freed you shall come unto me. I am the same to all beings, to me none is disliked or dear, but those worshipping me devout are in me and I am in them. If even an evildoer worships me single-heartedly, he should be considered righteous, truly having rightly resolved. Quickly he becomes virtuous and goes to everlasting peace. O son of Kunti, understand, my devotee is never lost. Women, Vaishyas, also Shudras, even those born of evil wombs, all those who take refuge in me, also go to the supreme goal. How much more than holy Brahmins and devoted royal sages, having obtained this transient and joyless world, then worship me. With mind fixed on me, devoted, worshipping, bowing down to me, thus made steadfast with me as your supreme aim, you shall come to me. Om Tat Sat. Thus in the Upanishads of the glorious Bhagavad Gita, the science of the eternal, the scripture of yoga, the dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna, ends the ninth discourse entitled The Yoga of the Kingly Science and Kingly Secrets. Chapter 10, The Yoga of Divine Glories. The Holy Lord said, now hear from me the supreme word, which I speak to you mighty armed, for you are beloved to me, I speak desiring your welfare. Neither the multitude of gods or great spheres know my origin. In truth, I am the source of the gods as well as of the great spheres. He who knows me as birthless and beginningless, the world's great Lord, he alone among mortals is undiluted and freed from sins. Reason, knowledge, non-delusion, forbearance, truth, restraint of sense, calmness, happiness, misery, birth, death, fear, also fearlessness, non-injury and contentment, austerity, benevolence, both good repute and ill repute, all these arise from me alone. The ancient seven great rishis and four manus with powers like me were born of my mind, and from them are all the creatures in this world. He who knows all these manifold manifestations of my power and glory becomes established in yoga, there can be no doubt. I am the origin of all, and from me everything evolves. Thinking thus, the wise worship me with consciousness, all filled with love. With minds and lives intent on me, enlightening one another, and speaking of me constantly, they are content and do rejoice. To them, the constantly steadfast, worshipping me with affection, I bestow the buddhi yoga by which they shall come unto me. Out of compassion for them I, abiding in their hearts, destroy the darkness born of ignorance by the shining lamp of knowledge. Arjuna said, supreme Brahman, supreme abode, supreme purifier divine, eternal person, the first God, the birthless and all-pervading. Thus all the sages declare you, Narada, Sita, Devala, and Vyasa, and now do you too yourself declare it unto me. I regard all this that you say to me as true, O Keshava. In truth, neither gods nor demons know of your manifestation. For you know yourself by yourself, O you, the Supreme Purusha, Source of beings, Lord of beings, God of gods, ruler of the world. You should now describe completely your divine manifestations, by which pervading all these worlds you do abide within all things. How may I know you, O yogi, always meditating on you? In what aspects of your being are you to be thought of by me? Explain to me in more detail your powers and manifestations. I am never satiated in hearing your Amrit-like words. The Holy Lord said, Listen, I shall tell you of my divine self-manifestations, but only the chief ones, because there is no end to my expanse. I am the Self abiding in the hearts of all beings. I am the beginning, the middle, and also the end of all beings. I am Vishnu of Adityas, the sun among luminaries. I am Marichi of Maruts, among the stars. I am the moon of Vedas, the Samaveda. I am Indra among the gods. Of the senses, I am the mind, intelligence in all beings. Among the Rudras, Shankara, Kubera of Yakshas, Rakshasas, of Vasus, I am Pavaka, and of mountains, Meru am I. And of priests, O son of Pita, know me, the chief Brahaspati. Of generals, I am Skanda, among the waters, the ocean. Of great rishis, I am Prigu, of words, the one-syllabled Om, of yajnas, the japa-yajna, of immovable Himalayas, of trees, I am the Ashwata, of deva-rishis, Narada, of gandharvas, Chitraratha, among siddhas, sage Kapila, among horses, Uchaishuravas, who was born of the Amrita, of elephants, Airavata, and among men I am the king. Among weapons, the thunderbolt, among cows I am Kamaduk, the cause of offspring, Kandarpa, of serpents I am Vasuki. Of nagas I am Ananta, of water beings, Varuna, of pitras I am Aryaman, of controllers I am Yama. Of demons I am Pralata, among measurers I am Time, among beasts I am the Lion, among birds I am Garuda. Of purifiers I am Wind, among warriors I am Rama, of fishes I am the Dolphin, of rivers I am the Ganges. Of manifestations I am, beginning, middle, and the end. Of knowledge, knowledge of the self, of disputants, I am logic. Among letters, the letter A, of compounds, I am the dual. I am inexhaustible time, I the sustainer, the all-formed. I am all-destroying death and origin of all that shall be. I am fame, prosperity, speech, memory, wisdom, courage, patience. Of chants I am Brahatsaman, of meters I am Gayatri, of months I am Margashirsha, of seasons the season of flowers. The gambling of the fraudulent, the splendor of the splendorous, I am victory and effort, I am Sattva of the Sattvic. Among Rishnis Vasudeva, of Pandavas Dhananjaya, among sages I am Vyasa, among the rishis Ushanas. The scepter of authority, strategy of the ambitious, of secret things I am silence, the knowledge of knowers am I. Whatever the seed of all beings, that also am I, Arjuna. No thing moving or unmoving can ever exist apart from me. Arjuna, there is no end of my divine manifestations. What I have spoken unto you is but an example of them. Whatever is glorious or prosperous or yet powerful, understand that springs from but a fraction of my radiant power. Of what value is it for you to know all this, O Arjuna? I ever support this whole world by just one portion of myself. Om Tat Sat. Thus in the Upanishads of the glorious Bhagavad Gita, the science of the eternal, the scripture of yoga, the dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna ends the 10th discourse entitled The Yoga of Divine Glories.
Good afternoon and good evening, and welcome to our second class in The Awakened Life, the Bhagavad Gita and the Path of Action, Part 2. It's an enormous pleasure for me to be back with you, to be listening to that gorgeous chant, and to be contemplating the teachings of truth and the path to truth that Krishna offers Arjuna. So let's begin with our chant. We'll begin chanting and meditating, and then we'll go into the, let's call it the vegetable of the class for vegetarians, the meat of the class for those who eat animal products. So our chant, our opening invocation chant, which is on your chanting sheet, says, I salute Madhava, whose name means sweetness, the source of supreme bliss, whose grace makes a dumb person eloquent and lets a cripple cross mountains. So we'll chant three times these verses, and you can find a posture that feels comfortable and upright. And in this particular posture moment, I'd like to suggest that you inhale with the feeling that the inhalation is flowing down from the crown and activating the region in the lower belly about 3 inches below the navel and about 3 inches, finger widths, 3 finger widths above the pubic bone. Deep inside the body is the hara, or the lower dantian, that aspect of the body, of the inner body, of the subtle body, that I think of as the center of being, the center of sat in the beautiful Sanskrit word sat-chit ananda, or being, consciousness, and bliss. So by focusing here in the hara, in the lower belly, as much as we can, we literally ground ourselves and make it possible for the energy in the body to connect to the earth and to the center of the universe at the same time. So, deep breath in, allowing the breath to bring your attention into the center of the lower belly. Long breath out, and in exhaling, I'd like to suggest that you draw the belly in towards the spinal column, allowing the belly to help you with the exhalation so that the exhalation can be full. And we'll take 3 more full exhalations, breathing into the lower belly, filling the lower lungs, upper lungs, and middle lungs and upper lungs completely, and then exhaling fully, drawing the belly in towards the spinal column, allowing all the breath to leave the lungs. So 3 full breaths. and we'll chant. Mukham karoti vachalam pangam langayate giram yat kripa tamaham vande paramananda madhavam. Mukham karoti vachalam pangam langayate giram yat kripa tamaham vande paramananda madhavam. Mukham karoti vachalam pangam langayate giram yat kripa tamaham vande paramananda madhavam. We ask that our practice be of benefit to all beings and to the earth. We offer our practice, asking that all beings be free of suffering. We offer our practice, asking that all beings know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. We offer our practice to Krishna, the self within the heart, the supreme being from whom all this arises and to which it subsides, that one who is known as the self, the supreme truth within all that is, as pure consciousness, as Vishnu, as Shiva, as Allah, as Kali, as Durga, that which is named by all creatures looking for refuge in their own way, that which pervades the world and gives it life. And during this class, we'll be talking about some of the qualities of that Supreme Being. So you can begin your posture, your meditation, by refreshing your posture if need be. Now begin to allow your attention to flow into through the front of the body. And I want to ask you to have the feeling that the sacred essence of this universe is entering through your body. It's entering through the pores of your skin, flowing in through the entire front of the body. And then with the exhalation, feel that this essence is poured out through the front of your body back into the universe itself. And I'm going to suggest those of you who took the first class will be familiar with this mantra. For those of you who aren't, I'll say it very clearly, and we'll be tuning into it throughout the class. So as the breath flows in through the front of the body, if it feels right to you at this moment, consider that the breath flows in with the mantra, Om Namo Narayanaya. Flowing in with Om Namo Narayanaya, which is one of the great mantras dedicated to Krishna. Allowing the breath to flow naturally with no words attached to it out through the body. And you can begin to inhale now with the sense that the breath is flowing in through the back of the body. Flowing in with Om Namo Narayanaya. Flowing in with the feeling that everything that is sacred and beautiful within this cosmos, the divine energies at the heart of everything, flow into your body with the breath and the thought, Om Namo Narayanaya. Now feel that the breath flows in through the right side of the body, flowing in with the mantra, and then flows out through the right side of the body. Now through the left side of the body. Now from below, actually feeling that the breath flows in from the earth herself up through the lower body with the thought, Om Namo Narayanaya. And now through the crown of the head. Allowing the breath to flow in through the crown down through your body, again with the thought, Om Namo Narayanaya on the inhalation, and then just allowing the exhalation to dissolve back into the ether above your head. And finally, open every pore of your body and feel that the prana shakti, the life force of the universe, which we are understanding as the essence of Krishna himself, life force is flowing in through every pore into your body from all sides with the thought, Om Namo Narayanaya, really as if the breath itself is calling on its source, is actually calling on the divine at the heart of the universe and at the heart of your own being. Hello again. So I want to take a few minutes as we continue to, first of all, we're going to do a tiny bit of review, but what I'd like to discuss is the overview, the overall viewpoint, the vision that Krishna offers Arjuna about the paths of yoga. Now, it's obvious that the Gita is a text of yoga. It's interesting that every chapter has the word yoga in the title. The, you know, beginning in chapter one, which is called the Yoga of the Despondency of Arjuna, which I've always felt draws our attention to the fact that at the stages, the places where we actually begin to follow the spiritual journey, to really give ourselves in full commitment to the spiritual journey, it does often begin with a feeling of depression or despondency. The most famous contemporary example, at least that I'm aware of, is Eckhart Tolle, who, as you many of you know, because I know many of you have read his work and listened to him and maybe even taken workshops with him, he had been studying spirituality for a while. He was a student at either Oxford or Cambridge University in England, and he went into this major depression and couldn't do anything except sit on a park bench. And it was in that depression that he had the experience that he often talks about, where he recognized that there was a part of him that was depressed and a part of him that was not depressed. And he started to wonder, are there two of me? And from that moment, the inquiry began that eventually showed him his real nature as consciousness. So this is actually the situation that Arjuna has come in on, although unlike Eckhart Tolle, Arjuna is not an intellectual. Arjuna is a warrior. He's a person of action. And every single one of the chapters in this book deal with one form or another of the path of the yoga. And again, in the Bhagavad Gita, yoga is a word that has many, many meanings, obviously, or at least we use it in many different ways. In fact, it essentially has one meaning. It means the practices that and the experience of being yoked to the true self. So the word yoga comes from the root yuk, which means yoke, as in Jesus's words, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Basically what I believe Jesus was saying in that passage was, my yoga, my path is easy. And one of the reasons that Jesus's path is said to be easy is because it is pretty much like Krishna's path. In other words, it's essentially a path of devotion, surrender, and recognition of what the truth of your nature is. Of course, there are differences, there are cultural differences, and there are certainly many differences in the way it's expressed. But essentially, what Jesus's teachings, Jesus's essential teachings, or what, you know, us mystics believe are Jesus's essential teachings, are essentially teachings of yoga. So Indian philosophy, as many of you are aware, is based on the four Vedas, the Rig Veda, the Krishna Veda, Yajurveda Veda, the Atharva Veda, and the Shukla Yajurveda, which are collections of hymns and rituals that for thousands of years have been considered the ultimate authority of Indian religion for any path or practice. So anybody who teaches philosophy in India has to, in some way, take account of the Vedas, has to kind of align with the Vedas. The Vedas are at the heart of the canon. They're not the only philosophy, and in fact, as human beings evolved from ancient times in India, obviously their religious practices evolved as well, and they evolved in not in a dissimilar way to the way it happened in other parts of the world, but I would say arguably in perhaps the most elegant way. I mean, I am a Hindu, so I tend to be prejudiced towards the Hindu Dharma. But in any case, the way that religion evolved in India was pretty darn elegant. So in the Vedas, the idea of dharma, which is, of course, crucial to the Bhagavad Gita, the idea of dharma, the divine law of right conduct, the holy law, so to speak, which, the you know, as again, as many of you know, the word dharma has the root of dhr, D-H-R, which means to uphold. So dharma is that which upholds everything. And in the Vedas, dharma had a specific meaning. It actually referred to the duty or the obligation that members of the top three castes, especially the priestly caste, had to perform daily rituals and make food offerings. So the idea here, and it's, I think it's a profound idea, which we follow in our own way, the idea was that the world, the cosmos, was upheld through the correct performance of these rituals. And again, as those of you who've studied Indian philosophy know, the rituals were all about making offerings to a fire, which had been kindled with mantras, and into which were offered food, gold, jewels, many, many more mantras. And the idea was that the ritual would be directed at particular elemental deities, and that these deities, of whom you had relationships with some, or in some cases all, that these deities would then, feeling nourished, would uphold the planet Earth. In other words, they would send down rain, they would make the crops grow. It was, you know, from some points of view, it was a form of pantheistic superstition, if you will. Although what we've come to realize in modern day, in our modern scientific understanding of the world, is that it actually is not that far off. In other words, we have come to understand in physical terms that this planet is an ecosystem, and that every part of it counts. What contemporary science hasn't quite grokked, though some people do, is the idea that this physical ecosystem also has an interior, a subtle ecosystem, which is what the Vedic sages were calling on when they did these rituals. And you know, the Vedas are also full of rules and protocols for living your life, but essentially they're instructions for affecting reality by your actions, by your ritual. So in the Vedic world, actions or karmas were essentially creative and performative. They were very specific things that you did. So the word karma refers to the steps in the rituals, the way the offerings were made. So the ritual actions were supposed to literally nourish the deity, the sun, who was seen as a deity, the air, Vayu, who was a deity, Indra, the thunder god, who was also the source of law in the cosmos. The ritual actions nourish the deity, adding to the power that the deity could use for maintaining the world. But, of course, they also nourished the human beings who performed the rituals. So at the heart of the Vedic Dharma was the idea that, number one, human beings had a cosmic duty to make offerings to the elemental forces, and that this was utterly, utterly necessary for the maintenance of the world. Along with it, the idea that when we made those offerings, it benefited us as well as the deities. In other words, you would kind of gain favor with the elemental forces through your offerings, and then they would do you favors. So it was a kind of win-win, parallel situation. And behind it was this profoundly life-affirming idea, which you also find in its own way in the Native American tradition, in the Aboriginal traditions in Australia, in many of the indigenous human traditions, that life itself is sacred, that the world itself is worthy of being honored and supported, and that human beings actually participate in the keeping the world together. And that this is important not just because, for the sake of some transcendent possibility, or for the sake of self-realization, but just for the world itself, just out of sheer love of life, which I think we all agree is a beautiful, beautiful way of seeing the world. So many of the great Vedic hymns celebrate the fact that every living creature, you know, every living creature, including the baby snake that turned up on my pillow yesterday, is a part of the cycle of life. And the Vedas put it kind of gorgeously in one verse, which I have always found both mysterious and encouraging. The verse says, I am food, I am the eater of food. I am food, I am the eater of food. I am both the eater and that which is eaten. So there's this profound sense that we're all participating in the sacrifice. You know, our own bodies will someday be offered back to the earth. And while I just found out that I had been cut from the call, so I'm back on the call, hopefully. So we were talking about making offerings and Vedic Dharma. When you make offerings in the old Vedic tradition, you also amass major benefits for yourself. And these personal benefits, which are known in Sanskrit as purushartha, that is to say the wealth of the individual, they include physical wealth, such as gold, food, and livestock, and, you know, experiencing more subtle worldly gains, such as abundance of good health and beauty and, you know, good offspring and beloveds of different kinds, and also the opportunity to experience different kinds of pleasures. So, you know, and as Krishna points out in chapter 2, for the performers of sacrifice, for the classic Vedic performers of sacrifice, performing rituals was something you did in order to succeed in life. And around the 6th century BCE, the sixth century, what we once used to call before Christ, before the Common Era, a second stage of the evolution of Indian thought about action began to emerge. So at this point, the rituals had been magnified to the point where people believed, first of all, that the world would fall apart without the rituals. But now, instead of the deity being the center of the ritual, the performer, the person performing the ritual, became the center. So in other words, sacrificial rituals became acts of status, at which, you know, which were mainly done for boons. And in other words, it became a business, essentially, as religion tends to do, you know, in certain stages. So the idea is the better the offerings, the richer the setting, the more priests you could afford to hire, the greater was your merit, and the more likelihood there was of your desires being fulfilled. So, for instance, when the king in the Ramayana wanted a son and heir, he and his queen performed a fire ritual, stating, and they always, and this is really important, and it's important to this day, at the beginning of the ritual, they would state their intention, their sankalpa, just as we do, just as we have learned more and more to do, because what they understood was that according to your intention, the ritual would bear fruit, which is kind of a wild idea. And again, it's one that in our time we've come more and more to understand and to work with, and we've discovered that it's true. So now it's not surprising, given the fact that rituals more and more were performed by kings and very rich people, that and the Brahmins, the priests who performed them, were very well paid. They actually began to specialize in certain kinds of rituals. And at the same time, many serious practitioners started to become cynical about rituals and priests, which, again, is not something we're unfamiliar with. It happens in every religious tradition. And it was about this time, which around 700 BCE, that the new, which was the, really the beginning of the, what's sometimes called the Axial Age, because it was when many of the great religious systems came into being. So these new movements began to arise. The yogis began to emphasize contemplation and self-inquiry over ritual, and a number of yogis, a number of priests, actually retired to forests where they created hermitages, and they began to teach disciples who were usually either members of their family or somehow related to them. And you know, they, as you again may know, the encampments of these sages and their disciples were called kulas. Kula meaning community, communities intended for the study and self-realization. And the teachings at this time were collected in the texts that are called the Upanishads. The word means sitting near. The Upanishads were the teachings of the forest sages to their students. And what's significant is that they were not so much interested in performing actions, though they continued to light fires and make offerings. That was utterly and completely a part of the Vedic lifestyle and continues to be even to this day for pious householders in India. But essentially they began inquiring into the nature of spirit. In other words, who is it that gives the fruits of the sacrifice? And does the creativity, does that creative power that gives rise to the physical world, is it actually present in the physical world, or is the world different from the power that created it? Is the physical world just matter, or does it have intelligence? And what about my body? Is it just, you know, dead matter? As it, you know, because after all, everyone's seen a dead body, and we know that when a body is dead, it's basically meat. It doesn't have any spirit in it. So another question, of course, the big question is the consciousness that manifests universes connected to our consciousness? And what's the connection between your soul and the deity? Are we like the deity? And what is it in us that's like those sacred entities? So these questions, which, again, they're foundational religious questions, these sages had intuited that the attitude and understanding of the person performing the ritual is just as important as the ritual. And they understood that what gave the act power was the state of consciousness of the person behind it. So, again, we know this. This is something we take for granted. It's one of the truths of life for, it has been for, basically since the time of these forest sages. It is really the beginning of the practice of internal yoga. So, in the process of thinking about the nature of reality, these sages discovered what is sometimes called the direct path, or the path of inquiry into the nature of the self. And of course, the direct path is the path where we absorb ourselves in the question of what is real. So they asked these questions, like, what is real? What is the self? What is that? I love this question. What is that by knowing which everything else is known? That's a trick question. It's a big question. What is it by knowing which everything else is known? The answer to that, of course, is your inner consciousness, because your inner consciousness, they had discovered, is the source of reality. So they had learned how to deconstruct experience such that they were able to tell the difference between the self and the objects of consciousness, the body, the earth, and thoughts and feelings. That is like a hugely sophisticated recognition. How quiet you have to be to discover this for yourself. I mean, we got to hear it. You know, we've been taught it. So we practiced with teachings. Some of these sages, I believe, actually worked it out for themselves. And this was how this incredible tradition that's known as Vedanta was born. Vedanta literally means, anta means end or last part. The Vedanta means the last part of the Veda. And the implication of Vedanta is that it expresses the true goal of life, the most mature vision of causation and reality available. In other words, Vedanta believes itself to be the truth. The most famous philosopher of Vedanta, Shankara, known as Shankaracharya, who was considered to be an incarnation of Lord Shiva and was a total renunciant, his his teaching was radically non-dualistic. Shankara taught, and his teaching was sort of the consolidation of the previous Upanishads. Shankara taught that reality is pure awareness, pure intelligence, and that it appears as solid only because of this weird power called Maya. Shankara basically believed that Maya was, some kind of extraneous power that came into the picture and veiled reality such that the soul was not able to recognize that it was a part of everything. The explanation of how reality works through Vedanta essentially says that there is this one consciousness which becomes the world. We're pretty familiar with that. This one consciousness remains free of the world even while manifesting as the world, but that in order to discover that the consciousness which has created all this is actually inside all this, in order to discover that this entire world is made of consciousness, we actually have to learn through yoga how to dissolve the world. In other words, how to make the world disappear into consciousness such that we realize that everything we see, hear, touch, taste, smell, and feel through the senses is actually appearing inside consciousness. It's a, how shall I say, it's an illusion, actually, of Shankara's words. It's an illusion to think that this physical world is real. And he has wonderful analogies for it. He says that the apparent reality of the world is like the castles of clouds in the sky. They appear substantial. And if you're in a plane looking down at clouds, you actually could feel like you could jump out of the plane and land on this soft, cottony cloud and be fully supported by it. Whereas, of course, that's not true because the cloud is just made of vapor. Shankara taught that the goal of human life, in fact, was to see through the illusion, to see through the cloud castle and realize the absolute transparency of everything, recognize everything was within you as consciousness. So let's do a practice. And the practice that we're going to do is, it's actually one of Shankara's favorite practices. It's the practice that he called Neti Neti, not this, not this. It's a practice that we still do today because it's very, very effective for those who can do it. Not everybody can. So we're going to try it now. So find yourself a posture. You can, if you've had a hard day and it's hard to sit up, you're welcome to lie down as long as you promise not to go to sleep. As always with meditation practices, sitting up is the most efficient way to practice, partly because of the way the body aligns and partly because it just keeps you awake. Close your eyes. We're going to do this with closed eyes. And find the breath. Now notice your body. And when I say notice your body, I mean let yourself fully feel yourself as your body, if that's appropriate, which is, I think, how many of us feel much of the time. So if you want, you can put your hand on your chest or on your thighs or on your face and feel the body through your sensing faculty. Feel into the body in terms of what you can sense, perhaps moisture under your armpits or inside your mouth. Perhaps you can feel the hair on your head. Maybe you can feel the touch of the clothes against your skin. So with awareness of the physical body, notice that there is something that knows the body, that's aware of the body. And that part of you that is aware of the body, see if you can focus on that awareness, on that intelligence that's capable of knowing the body, and recognize this consciousness that knows the body, which is aware of the body. Is not only much closer to me than anything else, we actually could say that this consciousness inhabits the body. What Shankara would say is, I have a body, I, consciousness, have a body, but I'm not my body. How do I know I'm not my body? Because I can observe my body. I can look at my arm, and something in me is aware of how it looks, how it feels, what the arm is wearing or not wearing. If I can observe my arm, if I can be aware of my arm, I'm not my arm. If I can be aware of my body, I'm not my body. This is essential Vedantic reasoning. So the next part of this is to become aware of the movement of breath. And then to recognize that awareness which senses the breath moving, which can actually follow the breath. Your awareness can hook itself to the breath and follow the breath as it comes in the nostrils and goes all the way down to the heart or wherever it ends up. You say to yourself, I have breath. Breathing is happening in this body. But because I can know the breath, that must mean I am not my breath. So again, go a little bit farther into the interior of what you think of as you and become aware of the thoughts that are arising, the images that are arising. Become aware, for example, that you're hearing my voice. You know that you're hearing my voice, and you also know that because you can hear my voice is not you. You're separate from my voice. And you're also separate from that faculty of hearing, which allows my voice to be heard. So Shankara would say, I have senses, and I experience stuff through the senses. But since I can observe my senses, I can actually detach myself from my senses. In other words, I can shut my eyes so I don't see. I can plug my ears so I don't hear. So I'm not my senses. And then you go into the mind and you notice the thoughts. And this is, as many of you know, an extremely powerful meditation practice. Who is it that knows your thoughts? Thoughts are arising and subsiding. There is an intelligence which knows them, which sees them. Just be present for that connection, that relationship, that yoga. So there's a yoga that is going on right now. This is one of the meanings of yoga, where thoughts are happening, awareness is aware of the thoughts, it now awareness becomes aware of the fact that it is aware of thinking. And perhaps the recognition dawns, oh, okay, that knowingness that is present to thoughts holds the thoughts, contains the thoughts. That awareness that is present to thoughts is not actually disturbed by thoughts, right? The awareness is there when a thought comes and when a thought goes. There's still something that knows the thought is there. I know this is apparent to many of you, not apparent to all of you, because the truth is that when the mind is very full of thoughts, it's sometimes difficult to distinguish the awareness that sees thoughts. Again, which is where the yoga comes in and where the practice comes in. So just be aware right now of that awareness which holds the thoughts and holds the sounds, that which knows that you're experiencing what you're experiencing. Can you stay present to the awareness that holds your experience? Recognizing, knowing that no experience would be possible if it were not for this awareness, for this consciousness, for this awake quality in yourself. And what Krishna is going to explain to us a little bit later on is that he is that awareness, which is the truly good news. So I'm going to suggest that those of you who are comfortable doing this actually try and listen to the rest of the class with the intention to tune back in to the awareness that knows you're here, that knows you're listening to these words, that knows you're practicing when we practice. Just see if you can keep some part of your awareness of awareness going throughout the class. And know that as you do, you are practicing Krishna's inner yoga as well as Shankara's inner yoga. So, deep breath in and release. Who knows your breathing? So, Shankara, as we said earlier, was part of a very widespread spiritual revolution, which would powerfully impact India herself, but also the way religious life was understood all over the world, because these changes were happening in other parts of the world as well. And that spiritual revolution in India included two new religions. One was Buddhism, and one was Jainism, which are somewhat similar, and somewhat similar to Vedanta. In fact, this is a joke that one of my former Swami friends used to make. It's one of the very famous accomplishments of Shankara, the great philosopher Shankara, was that he would go around India debating scholars and teachers. And the rule was that if you lost the debate, you had to either become a disciple of the winner or leave town. And Shankara was a really, really good debater. He pretty much defeated everybody, including his contemporary Buddhists. And eventually, the story goes, kicked the Buddhists out of India, where, as my friend said, they then took over the rest of the world, or they certainly took over a great part of Asia. One of the important hallmarks of the new religions, including Buddhism, was that they all included this idea of reincarnation, which was not so important in the Vedic tradition, but it's a kind of a no-brainer, reincarnation, from a certain point of view. And reincarnation was also a part of Egyptian religion, early Hebrew religion. So it was not an unusual idea, and it came out of, apparently, people's observations of how nature is constantly renewing itself through the cyclic process of death and rebirth. From this, from observing the world around them and from understanding that human beings are also part of nature, the sages began to recognize that human beings also transmigrate through different bodies. This was the big revolutionary understanding. We die, and then we're reborn in different forms. The teaching, which is still apparent in this world, it's still known in modern times, was that energy can't be created or destroyed, but simply changes form. And this idea of energy changing form is very significant, certainly in the Indian tradition. Krishna says there is no becoming of what did not already exist. There is no unbecoming of what does exist. In other words, if something is here, the energy of which it's made never dies, and if something is not here, it can't be found. Along with the doctrine of reincarnation came the other insight, which is that if we do die and get reborn in different bodies, then the fruits of our actions must be reborn along with us. In other words, the doctrine of karmic impressions began to be taught. It's a really significant part of Buddhism. Even more of Buddhism than it is of Hinduism, but it's definitely a significant part of Hinduism. As Krishna tells Arjuna in chapter 8, that, you know, just as, actually it's not chapter 8, I apologize, it's in chapter 1, it's one of the premises of the Bhagavad Gita, that as Krishna tells Arjuna, he's not going to be able to kill his cousins, because his cousins are going to die anyway, and then once they die, they will eventually be reborn, because that's how it works. So, and he fundamentally tells this to Arjuna as good news. In other words, it's an opportunity for you to continue succeeding in the world. But in fact, the understanding of reincarnation, you know, is good news, but it's also really bad news. And in fact, it can be kind of terrifying, because when you recognize that rebirth is endless, that we're on a path of endless cyclic recurrence, known in Sanskrit as samsara, which literally means the wandering. It means that everything we do, our activities, including our sacrifices and our rituals, which endlessly create results, they create pleasant, you know, results. Hi, guys. Apparently there's some karmic disconnection going on here. And as I was dialing back into the call, I started noticing what was happening in my mind. So this is kind of an example of how karma works. So first of all, when Deb texted me that I had gone offline, I didn't notice it. And then as I started to dial, I started thinking, oh my God, what did I do wrong? Did I pull the phone out of did I pull the cord out of the phone? Then I realized that I hadn't done it. It had just happened. The recognition that this just happened, that A, it wasn't my fault, which for someone with a mind like mine is a good thing, but second, that it was something that I wasn't able to control, which is, according to the way my mind works, a bad thing, I realized that this is actually one of the dilemmas that human beings face all the time around action. We have control over certain aspects of it, but there are other aspects of it over which we have no control. And this recognition that essentially reality is not under our control is a profound and rather scary idea. And when we join it to the notion of reincarnation, and we start to realize that we actually could end up in another body under circumstances that we really won't like at all, there does tend to be the desire to find a place of refuge. So Buddha, in his extraordinary teachings, and let's face it, Buddha's teachings are unbelievably wonderful. Buddha, in his teachings, brought in a completely different viewpoint than the Vedic sages had had. Buddha and the Vedantins and the Jains, in other words, all these new religions, saw the world as a horror show. Whereas the Brahmanical tradition, the early Vedic tradition, was deeply world-embracing. They thought of the world as beautiful, as the arena of growth and blossoming. They understood death, but they also understood that death was not an end, but simply a sleep, as it were. They felt themselves to be in a very happy transactional relationship with the forces that ran the world. The Buddhists, the Vedantins, and the Jains described the world as a burning fire, a source of terrible suffering in the present due to all the ills that can befall the body, and untold possible suffering in the future. So, and again, as we know, the first of Buddha's Four Noble Truths was life is suffering. His second was there is a path out of suffering, and essentially what he said is that, what he goes on to say is that the path out of suffering is giving up all attachments. Attachments to anything physical or emotional, to the world, to your family, and certainly to the religion of the priests. So, again, these new teachers, like Jesus, actually, were very cynical about priests and rituals. They had basically figured out the business of religion. And they believed that the rituals were essentially a scam, especially Buddha. Early Buddhism was not at all about rituals, but it was about merit, and it was about karma, and it was about getting free. These Brahmanical sects, all of these anti-Brahmanical sects, essentially believed that sannyasa, which means renunciation, was the correct lifestyle for a serious spiritual practitioner. And as you know, this idea has been carried through ever since, certainly in Western religions. You know, there's a very, very strong prejudice, at least for serious spiritual practitioners, towards renunciation. One of the important contemporary non-dual teachers from a Catholic contemplative tradition talks about how when she had her first awakening, she was not taken seriously because she was not a nun. She was she was a regular person, the mother of teenage children, and the religious authorities in her town believed that only priests, only monks and nuns could have serious spiritual experience. So this idea of renunciation of family and world is very, very crucial to the religions that began, around 700 BCE. Even though nowadays, of course, Buddhists are not all renunciates, even though in some places it's a tradition for young people to take monk's vows for a period. Nonetheless, this prejudice towards renunciation is very deeply embedded in Buddhism. So this was the background into which Krishna offered his teachings about yoga and also his theory of Karma Yoga, which as you know, is really, 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 really deeply revolutionary. So, in fact, in the first three or four chapters of the Gita, Krishna spends a lot of time acknowledging and expounding these philosophies before settling into his core message, which is fundamentally about bhakti. I've come to realize through my studies of this text over the last 6 months or so that the core of the Bhagavad Gita is not Karma Yoga, although Karma Yoga is certainly really important, but Bhakti Yoga, the yoga of devotion. Because part of what Krishna says, and it's part of what we all need to work with as we follow the path, really, because the Bhagavad Gita is, I do believe, one of the greatest guidebooks to the spiritual journey, as so many of you are feeling. But we need to figure out, or we need to find a way to be devoted in a way that works for us, because obviously not all of you, not all creatures, not all human beings have what we consider a personal relationship with a form of deity. So this question of how you work with the the four main paths that Krishna expounded has been a topic of discussion ever since the Gita first began being taught. So again, the teachings, the paths that Krishna pointed out, and I know this is not news to most of you, but I just want to say it. The paths that Krishna pointed out were, first of all, Karma Yoga, the path in which actions are performed and offered to the divine, and the fruits of those actions are given up. This is, of course, a hugely significant teaching and probably the most famous of all Krishna's teachings. You have a right to the action alone, but not to its results. An unbelievably revolutionary teaching. He begins with Karma Yoga, which he offers to Arjuna, as we'll recall, precisely because Arjuna is on the verge of fighting a terrible war, and he has decided that the consequences of the war are too terrible, so he doesn't want to fight it. What Krishna tells him is that there is a way to fight this war without incurring sin, a word he doesn't use that much, but which was definitely on Arjuna's mind at the time. You can fight this war full on and do no wrong if you give up any thought of benefiting from the results of the war. So, in other words, when you detach from your desire for the fruits of your actions are no longer binding. That means you don't have to be reborn again to reap the fruits of your actions, whether they're positive or negative. And not only that, as you go through this life, you're not going to be limited by the consequences of anything that you've done. This, as long as you are acting without desire for the fruits, without desire for the results. Now, you and I know that this is easier said than done. That's why Karma Yoga is a yoga. It's not a no-brainer. It's actually something that we need to cultivate. So Krishna's addition to this, and again, we're talking here about the teachings that he gives in the first, essentially, three chapters of the Gita, and then goes on to expound in the rest of the text. Krishna then says, in order to renounce the results of your actions, you also have to understand the truth about who you are. In other words, you need to follow the path of Jnana Yoga, the yoga of knowledge, as well as the path of Karma Yoga, because you can't really renounce the fruits of your actions unless you understand that your true being is not bound by the body, is not bound by your mind, and is not bound by any of the qualities of your personality. So in other words, you have to deconstruct your sense of identity through the process that's called jnana, which literally means knowledge, but which, as many people have pointed out, the yoga of knowledge, jnana yoga, is actually the yoga of disbelieving everything you think you know. In other words, it's the yoga of deconstructing your ideas about yourself, which we just did. You know, you think you're your body, but realize you can observe your body, therefore you're not your body. You are the awareness, you're the consciousness, you're the self that lives in the body. So he introduces jnana yoga in order, really as the engine through which it becomes possible to give up the fruits of your actions. And then, at that point, he introduces the deeper recognition, which is Krishna's core metaphysical teaching. That is, the person who lives in the body, the indweller, as he's called, the owner of the body, the deha sharira in Sanskrit, the one who observes what happens to the body but is not affected by it. Krishna says, that is me. That's me, Krishna. In other words, your consciousness, your soul, does not belong to an individual. Your soul is part of the great soul, which you call Krishna or Vishnu. The word he uses, actually, the word that Krishna uses is Purushottama, which means supreme being. Purusha means person. Ottama means that which is beyond the beyond. So the Purushottama is the supreme person who is the source of this world. And Krishna says that, in other words, I live in your heart. I can be discovered through yoga. And the way to find me in your heart is to love me, both in your heart and in any other way you possibly can. So this teaching about the supreme being dwelling in the heart, which actually is a part of many of the exoteric religions, certainly the Western religions, are essentially theistic religions in which the personal deity, the divine being, is said to dwell inside the body, inside human consciousness, and in most cases to be accessible through the heart. But Krishna's teaching is esoteric. So what he is teaching Arjuna is what's called Advaita Bhakti, or non-dual devotion. In other words, his foundational teaching is a synthesis of these three paths: Karma Yoga, which is actually a reformulation of the old teachings about action; Jnana Yoga, which begins as the separation of the knowing awareness, the consciousness, from everything it knows; and Bhakti Yoga, which essentially he says is the secret of self-realization. In other words, essentially what he says is that you cannot renounce the fruits of your actions just by deciding to do it, and you cannot know the truth of the self as your real being just because you decide to do it. In order to recognize the truth about who you are and to live in it, you need help. You need help from me. And the true path to receiving divine help or divine grace is by paying attention to me, by meditating on me, by contemplating me, by loving me, by the path of devotion, which is, on one level, is definitely a path of love. In other words, the secret of the path of devotion is falling in love with the divine. But because the sages and Krishna himself are compassionate, they also realize that we can't just fall in love with the divine just because we want to. So he offers a series of practices for cultivating your awareness of the divine, which include chanting mantra, telling stories. It's the purpose of all these mythological stories. And visual contemplation, dialoguing. So what we see is that the path of the devotional yoga, which, as I say, is Krishna is going to be speaking about at great length in the final six books of the Gita, which is where we're going, he offers in this section of the text a series of practices for kindling that devotion. And part of what he is going to explain to Arjuna, and we'll be talking about this much more next week, is that the practices of yoga are ultimately about connecting yourself to the Supreme Being, but it's also about all the things you do when you're not feeling connected to get yourself more connected. And, of course, in his teaching of Karma Yoga, the really key thing that he points out to Arjuna is that the war that he's about to fight in can be done as a religious ritual, as an offering to the divine, as a yoga. And that means it can be done, and must be done, actually, by being very conscious of giving up anything that causes selfish desire and the anger that arises from selfish desire. So Krishna tells Arjuna, renounce the fruits of your actions right now. Decide in advance that whatever you do is not for your advantage or for the advantage of your family. You're doing it only because it's the right thing to do. You're not decide that you're acting for the sake of right action alone, for the sake of dharma alone. And because if you don't act, the world will be the poorer. your life means something. Your life is needed. Your actions are needed. You're not extra. You're a serious part of this world. Now, obviously that's true of Arjuna, because Arjuna is a prince and he's the best warrior in, you know, the entire family, and he's the person who's going to basically win the war for the Pandava family. But what Krishna wants to point out is that this is true for each one of us, that the meaning of swadharma, of personal, the personal law, personal obligation, is that there's nothing that, there's no part of this world that's not utterly crucial for the maintenance of the whole world. And I want to tell you a story about swadharma, partly because it's one of my favorite stories, but also because it illustrates about as well as any I know what the essence of Krishna's teaching to Arjuna really is. And the story goes that in the city of Delhi, during the reign of the Buddhist emperor Ashoka, there's a huge flood. The river Yamuna, which runs through the city of Delhi, is in flood, and it's covered the banks, and it's covering the ground floors of all the houses, and it's a crisis in the city. So the king goes down to the banks of the river and asks his ministers for advice. And the ministers say, well, this is a really bad flood. It'll probably go down, you know, in a couple of days. But if you want it to go down now, why don't you try performing an act of truth? And an act of truth is a very specific and significant practice of the classical Indian tradition, in which somebody makes a statement that in which he claims by the power of truth to be able to perform an action that is not normal in nature. So, and the way you perform an act of truth is to claim the dharma of your life, to claim the integrity of your personal dharma. So the king says, and this is the way the act of truth goes, if I have at all times ruled righteously, I claim an act of truth by which this river will return to its natural course. So he makes a statement, nothing happens. The river goes right on filling up the town. So he calls various other people, ministers and his queen and other important people in the town, and he has them all make a statement about their integrity. None of them has an effect on the river. So finally, this old prostitute comes waddling up. She's enormously fat. She's quite old. She's been out of business for a while. And she says to the king, I have an act of truth. So the king says, okay, make your claim. The prostitute says, If I have served my customers with complete equanimity, not favoring rich people over poor people, making love with everyone who pays me without exception, with complete evenness of mind, if I have performed my actions in this way, by this act of truth, may the river return to its normal course. And of course, the river immediately shrank back to its ordinary state. And the point here is, of course, that what matters is not whether the actions are, so to speak, auspicious or moral. What matters is that you do them as offerings with integrity, even-mindedly, whatever it is you're doing. And I guess this would also apply to people doing illegal activities. Krishna doesn't say, by the way, nor does this story say that anything you do is fine. What it says is that anything you do that is done selflessly, that is without the desire for personal gain, will not be binding. And what I think most of us realize is that if you're not acting for personal gain, in other words, if you're performing your actions solely for the sake of the action, then the chances of you're doing something that's harmful to another person are practically non-existent. Because selflessness, true selflessness, is one of the ways that we ensure that our actions are correct. Now, I say this knowing that depending on your understanding, depending on what you think is true about the world, you could cause great harm thinking that you are acting selflessly. And I would say that some of the terrorists that we, who are making our life so difficult, probably come under this category. They very well may be acting with the idea that they're performing selflessly for the good of all, and in fact doing terrible things. This is why Krishna says to Arjuna, and it's really, really important, that in order to perform karma yoga in a truly liberating way, you have to have true knowledge of who you are. In other words, it's not just acting and offering your actions. It's also really understanding who is offering and who is acting. And what Krishna is going to go on to tell Arjuna is, the only person who's acting is me, Krishna. In other words, you, Arjuna, despite your various imperfections as a character, which of course we all have, and despite the fact that you think you're the body and the personality, the fact is that you, Arjuna, are actually made of pure spirit, and your spirit is me. And not only that, your spirit, which is me, pervades everything. So, by the way, it's also in your cousins. So even as you fight this war, and in chapter 11 of the Bhagavad Gita, as you know, Krishna shows Arjuna a vision in which he sees all the warriors in the battle being sucked into the jaws of death. So Krishna doesn't fancy up the picture of what happens in war. It's very clear, he makes it very clear to Arjuna that what happens in this war is actually horrific. The thing that makes it redeemable is, first of all, that the war is actually being undertaken for the sake of the world. In other words, it's a just war. But more than that, what makes it, let's say, okay, is the fact that all the warriors ultimately will not die. They will simply be reborn in different bodies according to the nature of their actions and according to what they believe about themselves. So this is the knowledge that allows us to perform our actions in the spirit of karma yoga. It's based on the recognition that we're not the bodies and minds within which we live. We're the knowingness that lives inside the bodies. So the prescription that the traditions offer about this, the traditional interpretations of the Gita, really kind of agree with Shankara. The traditional interpretations of the Gita say that true knowledge, the knowledge we need, is the understanding that we're pure spirit, not the body. And essentially what the traditions say is that we have to realize that we are separate from the body and separate from the world. Okay, I'm back. I'm so sorry. Hopefully you're all meditating as you wait for me to come back on the line. One of the points that Abhinavagupta, who is the great non-dual commentator, tantric commentator on the Bhagavad Gita, one of the points that Abhinavagupta makes is that the divine Krishna, whom he calls Shiva or Kali, but means the same thing as Krishna, not only lives within us as our untouched spirit, but also lives within us as our thoughts and actions. Because what the tantric vision of the Bhagavad Gita, what the tantric vision of life is that everything that occurs in the visible and invisible worlds is actually being done by the divine consciousness, love, by Krishna himself, by Shiva himself, by God himself, by the Supreme Spirit. And it's, you know, in these non-dual traditions of which both Krishna and Abhinavagupta are exponents, non-dual devotion is really the secret of understanding the way the world works, because, as Abhinavagupta says, as the tantras say, there is only one consciousness that has become all this, and that consciousness is inherently creative. Everything that happens in this world is a function of the divine transcendent powers of will, which is another name for desire, of knowledge, and of activity. And that includes our actions. So what Krishna is telling Arjuna is everything that you do with your body, with your mind, with your speech, every thought you think, all of these are being done actually by me, by my divine powers. Everything is Krishna. And essentially what he's saying, and this is what I'm hoping that you will read this week with the understanding of, since your consciousness is not different than Krishna's consciousness, and since all your actions and thoughts are in reality Krishna's actions and thoughts, you do not act independently. In other words, when you're acting spontaneously, when you're acting naturally, without interjecting your wrong understanding about who you are, then everything you say and do and think actually comes from the power of divine freedom, the swatantriya of the great Lord, of Krishna himself. So your natural actions, including the actions of your swadharma, are naturally imbued with freedom and bliss. In other words, Krishna is acting as you, through you, and your problem, your propensity to create what the texts call binding karmas, to get trapped by your actions or your thoughts, comes entirely from your failure to recognize the all-pervasiveness of Krishna, which, in other words, it's entirely a mistake of our conception. It's a misconception. So Krishna is saying, essentially, that ultimately it doesn't really matter what our actions are. And I know this is a seriously confusing teaching if we haven't realized it. That is, if we're not experiencing it. But from an ultimate point of view, there is no such thing as good or bad actions, because there's only Krishna. And this is what Krishna says in chapter 5. A true yogi who acts without ignorance, that is, who knows that it's only Krishna who acts, can be continuously engaged in activity. He doesn't have to retire from the world. He doesn't have to give up anything, including worldly activity, because he can remain as unattached as the rays of the sun on a pool of mud, because he knows that his true nature is consciousness and that his consciousness is the consciousness of the divine. And he sees that in everything else and everyone else. So Krishna says, the enlightened ones, throughout the Gita, Krishna is telling Arjuna in many, many ways what it looks like to be enlightened. So he says, the enlightened ones perceive the same in a Brahmin, a scholar endowed with learning and humility, in a cow, in an elephant, in a dog, and even in a eater of dogs. Eating dogs was considered a very bad thing to do in Krishna's day. And what that, and Abhinavagupta says in his commentary, the fully realized yogi doesn't think that one kind of person is pure and another is impure. So the implications of this, of course, are huge. And essentially what Krishna is saying is that this, it's the self that's untouched. Actions performed ignorantly, and he will go on to talk about this in great detail later on. Actions performed selfishly out of ignorance under the control of the gunas can be hugely unskillful and problematic. So he's not saying anything is okay. What he's saying is that no matter what you do, your nature is pure. In other words, you have Buddha nature. I'm reminded of a story that I heard about one of my former teachers from someone who was very close to her. And the two of them were talking about a person that, Kathy, the one who told me the story, I'll just use names, that Kathy really thought was a terrible person who had done some very, very inappropriate things. And she was saying, you know, this person is blah, 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 blah. And the teacher said, you know, the other day I was talking to this person, and as I looked at him, I saw that his entire body was blazing with light. And I realized that no matter what he does, this person is made of light. His heart of hearts is completely pure. And this is how Abhinavagupta explains it. He uses a quote from the Vijnana Bhairava. He says, the same self in the form of pure consciousness is present in all bodies. There is nowhere an exception to this rule. A yogi who realizes that everything is identical with that consciousness rises above transmigratory existence. So this is the deep truth. When it comes to being enlightened, what matters is your recognition of who you are and what lives in all creatures. Because once you see that, then your actions are naturally going to be unselfish. Okay, take a deep breath in. And we'll return for this meditation to the practice that we were doing during the week. That is, we'll meditate on the central channel, the Sushumna Nadi, with the mantra, this time with the mantra, Om Namo Narayanaya. So as you inhale, have the feeling that the breath flows in through the crown down to this space in the core of the belly. And as the breath flows out, feel that it flows back up the central channel, out the crown. And with the inhalation, have the thought, Om Namo Narayanaya. Just let the Sanskrit mantra, which means, I bow to that supreme being whose nature pervades this world. Just allow those sounds to slip down your central channel with the breath. And then let the exhalation just flow upward through the channel. One of the truths implied in the Gita is that the requirements for our actions will be different according to our level of consciousness, and this goes for our meditation as well. So, for instance, when we're deeply identified with the body and personality, our practice will demand very deliberate discipline. So we often need to work quite rigorously to become the witness of our self-destructive habits and to forgive ourselves for the things we've done that feel imperfect. We need to create times for practice. We need to study. We need to work with our own mind. We might have a lot of doubt and confusion to begin with, which means that it's important to have satsang, to have spiritual friends who you can have conversations about the truth with, and also that it's important to receive teachings, which fortunately is much easier these days with the internet than it ever used to be. And it also means that it's important to cultivate a kind of one-pointedness, in other words, to accept a teaching or a teacher and follow it, mainly in order to avoid confusion and doubt, which Krishna says is actually about the worst thing you can do for your practice, is to doubt its efficacy. As we begin to experience the truth about our own awareness, and when I say begin to experience, that experience could be very small, but the more we know ourselves as awareness, the more we experience our own subtlety. It doesn't have to be total self-realization, just the recognition that there's more to this than meets the eye. Then our practice can become subtler as well. For instance, we begin to trust our own guidance. We begin to realize that we don't have to do our practices with a fundamentalist attitude, but we can choose practices according to how we understand it. We need to rebalance our consciousness. So, for example, if we're hatha yogis, we may decide to do less physical practice and more meditation. Or if we're deep meditators who don't do much physical practice, we may decide to give more time to yoga or tai chi. So in other words, we expand our understanding about what we need. And then there comes a point where more and more of your experience is of just living in the world in a state of equanimity. We got a couple of emails today from people in the class saying that even though they didn't necessarily notice the effects of their practice in the short term, that during crises, difficult times, they saw that they actually have a great deal more equanimity and capacity for dealing with discomfort than they ever had before they started doing practice. And, you know, in other words, practice works. And the kind of practices that we do, taking the help of grace, and again, I've found this to be enormously important, will literally transform you over time into the person that Krishna is talking about when he talks about the true yogin, or the enlightened being. And at a certain point, we do start to realize that that which we've been searching for is not only our own consciousness, but actually can be found in everything. I know that for me, when I do retreat, one of the real gifts or earmarks of the fact that I have fully entered retreat is that I start looking around and seeing the world of arising from inside me. I begin to be able to see the sacredness in the world. So this is one of the effects of practice that Krishna invites us to. And in chapter 10, and we're going to conclude this class by reading from and contemplating some of what Krishna says to Arjuna in chapter 10. Chapter 10 is all about the glory and the splendor of Krishna's incarnations, not just in his physical body, but in the world itself. Arjuna, by this time, is no longer calling Arjuna his friend and charioteer. He's calling Arjuna Purushottama. He's stopped being the warrior ready for battle. He's become a spiritual seeker talking to his guru. They've, at this point in the text, they've given up any pretense that this is a teaching about war. It's completely become a teaching about how to know the truth. So this chapter is called the Yoga of Divine Splendor. It starts when Arjuna asks Krishna to tell him more about his glories. How do you appear in the world? Who are you? And Krishna gives him the skivvy on how he appears in the world. In this particular chapter, he's essentially talking about himself as his splendors, as the beauties and skills and leadership capacities that exist in the world. So he's not really talking so much about the, so to speak, negative aspects of life. But he has already said, and this is his secret, I pervade the entire universe in my unmanifested form. All creatures find their existence in me, but I'm not limited by them. I'm not confined within them. Fools do not look beyond physical appearance to see my true nature as the Lord of all creation. And that what that means is that they don't see that in themselves, and they don't see it in the world. But truly great souls seek my divine nature. They worship me with a one-pointed mind, having realized that I am the eternal source of all. Constantly striving, they make firm their resolve and worship me, singing my divine glory. Others follow the path of knowledge, spiritual wisdom. They see that wherever, whatever exists is me. Where there is one, that one is me. Where there are many, they are all me. They see my face everywhere. I am the ritual and the sacrifice. I am medicine and mantra. I am the offering and the fire that consumes the offering, and I am the one to whom it is offered. I am the father and mother of this universe. I am its entire support. I am the syllable Om. I am the sacred scriptures. I am the Atman, the self within the whole, within the heart. I am the goal of life, the inner witness, the abode of all. I am the only refuge, the one true friend. I am the beginning, the middle, and the end. Discrimination, wisdom, understanding, forgiveness, truth, self-control, peace of mind, all these are me. Pleasure and pain are me. Birth and death are me. Fear and courage, honor and dishonor, non-violence, charity, equanimity, contentment, perseverance, all the different qualities found in living creatures have their source in me. So Arjuna says, tell me your divine attributes, leaving nothing unsaid. Tell me the glories within which you fill the cosmos. Tell me, and this is really the point which I want to offer you for the week to come, tell me how I should meditate to gain constant awareness of you. In what things and in what ways should I meditate on you? So Krishna says, I will tell you my divine powers, Arjuna. I'm only going to give you the most glorious, because there are so many, I could never mention them all. I am the true self in the heart of every creature, Arjuna. Among the shining gods, I am Vishnu. Of lights, I am the sun. In the night sky, I am the moon. Among the senses, I am the mind. And in living beings, I am consciousness. Among human beings, I am the king. Among weapons, I am the thunderbolt. Among animals, I am the lion. Among birds, I am the eagle. Among purifying forces, I am the wind. Of water creatures, I am the crocodile. Of all the sciences, I am the science of self-knowledge. I am the capacity for discernment among scholars. Among letters of the alphabet, I am the letter A. And this is a really crucial piece of esoteric knowledge for those of you who are students of mantra. I am death, which overcomes all, and the source of all beings still to be born. I am the feminine qualities of fame, beauty, perfect speech, memory, intelligence, loyalty, and forgiveness. Among seasons, I am spring. I am the gambling of the gambler and the falsehood of the fraudulent. I am the radiance in all that shines. I am effort. I am victory. I am the goodness of the virtuous. I am the silence of the unknown, the wisdom of the wise. I am the punisher among punishments. I am statesmanship in those who lead. I am the seed that can be found in every creature, for without me nothing can exist. And then he says, wherever you find strength or beauty or spiritual power, you may be sure that these have sprung from a spark of my essence. But of what use is it to you to know all this, Arjuna? Just remember that I exist and that I support the entire cosmos with only a fragment of my being. So this is the meditation we will close with. Just close your eyes and think of everything that you've experienced today. Think of the beauty that you've become aware of. Think of things that you've read or seen or noticed that felt good to you. Think of the sun, think of the clouds, think of the trees, think of your computer. Think of your children and your friends. Just let your mind roam over everything that you've come in contact with in the course of this day and name it all as an aspect of the Supreme Being. Name it all as pure consciousness, pure love. Name it all as creative freedom. Name it all as Krishna. This is the meditation that my teacher used to say is the best of all meditations. Wherever you look, wherever your mind goes, Krishna is all you find. That includes your thoughts. That includes the rumbling in your stomach. That includes your feeling that you're not really experiencing everything as Krishna. You're just doing an exercise. That includes the tears that might be arising. That includes the problems of your day. All of it. Every single moment, thought, particle of air, and inner experience is Krishna. So, in this moment, as you segue out of meditation and on with your day, in this moment, and as much as possible for the rest of the evening, as I was saying, for the remainder of the evening, please see if you can stay aware of Krishna. See if you can find that supreme love awareness inside yourself and at the heart of everything that you see and touch and come in contact with. Have a beautiful evening, a beautiful week, and we'll be in touch. So much love. Good night.